from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, we meet Tim O'Reilly, the founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media and the man many consider Silicon Valley's leading intellectual. He'll join us as part of our first-person series on local leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. And he'll talk with us about tech trends, the future of work, and what he calls the WTF economy. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Tim O'Reilly has been called the Oracle of Silicon Valley. His tech publishing and conference empire helped legitimize the open source movement in the late 90s. And his company also helped popularize the maker movement by launching Maker Magazine and Maker Faire. And these days, O'Reilly is pondering the future of what he calls the WTF economy. The term WTF, he writes, conveys amazement and dismay, both legitimate reactors to new technologies that are dramatically enhancing our lives and threatening massive economic displacement. He joins us as part of our first-person series on local leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. And good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. And where do we begin talking to someone called an oracle? I know you're a modest man, but how do you get to be called an oracle, other than maybe giving advice to Eric Schmidt and Jack Dorsey and people like that?
Well, there's actually a secret to that quote. It was in, I believe it was in Fast Company, or no, Inc. It was an Inc. magazine profile of me. And the real secret was that somebody compared me to the woman in The Matrix who baked cookies. Because I'm sort of famous for baking scones when people come to see me. And so it was – and of course, she was an oracle, but it was sort of a mixed metaphor. Now, again, I do think I have had a track record of being able to talk about big issues often before people have recognized them. But I think what I really try to do is draw maps that – help people think a little differently about what's going on in the world today. So I don't think of myself as a futurist. I think of myself as somebody who helps us to understand the present. William Gibson famously said, "The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet." By the way, he said that on the NPR interview once. So, and I'm the one who sort of heard it and popularized it ever since. So it's entered the lingo. But you know, there are these amazing, you know, signs of the future all around us. And a lot of what we just have to do is look at it with fresh eyes and redraw the map because, you know, and again, we could go into some of the history of how I've done that in the past, but I'm really interested in talking now about some of the issues that we're facing today. We're in this situation where there's a lot of fear, a lot of stories about technological unemployment. This time it's different. The robots are going to take the jobs. And I'm not sure that that's the right narrative for how we should be thinking about the technologies that are coming at us. And that's why I've used the term the WTF economy.
Yeah, we can't necessarily define what those letters stand for, but what is it?
Well, they stand for what's the future, of course.
Oh, okay.
but, you know, if you think about the term WTF, it's an expression both of amazement and of dismay. You know, and if you look at the world today, WTF, you know, you've got what appears to be an AI assisting doctors, writing news stories, you know, trading stocks. You have the ability to call a car on demand. There's more Uber drivers in San Francisco than there were than the entire size of the taxi industry before. You know, you've got a company, another, you know, again, somewhat controversial sometimes, Airbnb with more hotel rooms effectively through this distributed network than the largest hotel chains have. These are expressions of amazement. But there's also, you know, these expressions of fear and dismay. You know, the robots are going to take our jobs. And not only that, when you look at how automation has been used in our culture, it has typically been used to dehumanize. It has been used to take away people's rights, you know, to drive jobs down. And that's one of the things that I found, for example, when I started digging in just be clear, I'm really digging into this. I have a conference that's happening later this week, Thursday and Friday, called the Next Economy Summit, not called the WTF Economy, because I feel like we have to get from the WTF Economy to the Next Economy.
You saved me from plugging it, but I will plug it again.
But I'm just trying to give you some context. So in researching that and putting together the program, I fell through kind of a rabbit hole into understanding how technology is used in low-wage work today. And we, for example, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how the on-demand economy, the gig economy, these are jobs with no safety net, with no fixed hours, you know, and you kind of hear the litany of horribles that are ascribed to it.
Algorithms are the new shift. I think that's how you put it.
Algorithms are the new
shift boss. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, that is also true at Walmart, at Starbucks, at McDonald's, at, you know, and it's a but it's a different algorithm. You know, the Uber or the Postmates or the Instacart algorithm is one that says, hey, we need workers, show up. It's a marketplace. But the algorithm at McDonald's or Walmart says, you show up now. And if you don't show up, you're fired. Not only that, we're going to make sure that you don't get more than 29 hours a week because we don't want to pay you health benefits. You know, you can control that algorithmically. Not only that, we say, oh, wait, we used to think we'd need you for an 8-hour shift, but now we know that demand goes in much smaller units and we need people 2 hours here, 3 hours there, and we'll let you know immediately. We're so real time. You know, that's a horrible vision of technology. And I think we're at this place where we're trying to understand how to use this technology in a better, more effective way, and I think ultimately in a more humane way.
Are you saying you can make it so that technology doesn't really supplant or replace jobs in great numbers? Because it certainly has.
Well, I think if you look at the history of technology in the past, there was huge disruption around the transition from the agricultural to the Industrial Revolution. Absolutely. There were horrible working conditions. And then we figured out how to take all that productivity and make a better society. I think we can do that again. And a lot of what I think we have to do is start thinking harder about that now and not thinking about it, you know, after there's a disaster.
Not being reactive, being proactive.
Exactly.
And yet, where is technology taking us in your judgment? I know you said you're not a futurist, and I respect that. But in general terms, can we quantify, can we specify where technology is taking us, particularly in light of, I mean, you mentioned, for example, I'll bring it into the mix here. You mentioned robots and artificial intelligence, but also drones now are coming into the picture in terms of monitoring work. Everything is changing as we're speaking here. I mean, things are changing moment to moment.
That's absolutely correct. I guess the first thing I would say, just again, this reminder that technology is deeply wrapped up with a set of choices that we make. And the thing that I most want to get people to think about is that the future is not inevitable. We make the future. And so, for example, there is a real possibility of a very dystopian future. But there's also a possibility of a future in which technology makes amazing things possible. You know, for example, there was a story in the media not long ago, say, oh my gosh, self-driving cars are going to wipe out truck driving, you know, and that's one of the largest, you know, categories of employment
Elon,
in America.
I must say that cars are going to be like horses and carriages, I mean, in terms of cars that we drive and we operate?
I think that that may well be the case. But what has happened in the past when we've actually, you know, when we stopped, for example, having to work on the farm, when you know, effectively machines increased our agricultural production. We were able to feed many more people, and we have to do that again. For example, if you look at drones, they're being used to increase agricultural yields because you can actually monitor the health of the fields, the amount of nutrients, the amount of water. There's all kinds of things you can do there that you couldn't do before that actually make that more productive. But in the same way, think about driving. What if driving became automated? What might our society look like? You can actually start to say, oh, well, maybe we could have some combination of what Paul Farmer did with Partners in Health in developing countries with home health workers. But this time they're being carried around by the equivalent of a self-driving car. They are empowered with something like IBM Watson to be able to get medical advice on the spot. They have telemedicine equipment so they can say, hold on, doctor, you need to see this. And they're able to visit people in their homes and make sure that people are taking their meds or getting the care they need. You know, we could do something different. And in this regard, I had a really interesting conversation with David Autor, the MIT labor economist. And, you know, we were talking about the concept of universal basic income, which is one of the proposed solutions to
poverty.
Well, to poverty, but also to this idea that more and more people, may not have full-time jobs. And he said, well, let's look at Norway. You know, he said they basically have this oil wealth. This is not technological unemployment, but it's basically a source of wealth. It's fairly distributed. And he said, look, people there, he said, every profession is valued, work is valued, and everybody works, they just work less. That's not a bad vision. You know, but instead we have this market ideology that somehow seems to think it's okay to basically cut our costs of labor to nothing, to screw people. And some people get super wealthy and somehow it's considered socialism if you try to distribute it more fairly. And I think it's really this really interesting guy named Nick Hanauer. He was one of the first investors in Amazon, sold a Quantive to Microsoft for $6 billion. He's a very wealthy guy. And he gave a talk at TED in 2012 where he said, I'm a wealthy capitalist. I'm sick and tired of hearing that capital creates jobs. Only one thing creates jobs, and that's customers. He said, and we've been screwing our workers for so long that they're not going to be able to afford to be our customers anymore.
We've been also hearing from the GOP for years that cutting taxes will increase jobs or will create jobs. But listen, isn't proposed regulation of things like Airbnb and Uber, aren't those examples of societies trying to make choices rather than accept the inevitable? And do you support such regulation?
You know, here's the thing I would say. It's one of the problems with regulation is that it's often a very, very blunt instrument. I wrote a piece about 5 years ago about something I called algorithmic regulation. And I tried to put government regulation in the context of other kinds
of— calling a government 2.0?
Part of it. Yeah. It's part of it. But think for a minute about something like Google's search quality. Right, that's a regulatory system. They're looking for bad actors. Or think about credit card fraud detection. That's a regulatory system. And what are the characteristics of those regulatory systems? They're actually changing the rules all the time in order to achieve an outcome. You know, and they're focused on the outcome. Google basically says, we want the search results to be good. And there's a bunch of people who are sitting there trying to go, I want my search results to be the top, whether they're good or not. Right. And so Google has to change the algorithm constantly, actually in periodic waves. They do small tweaks, but they do some major versions. Same thing, credit card fraud. You know, there's always new attacks, always new approaches. Government regulation, by often they go, OK, we made this rule and now we've got to live with it for the next 15 years. You know, and in the case of, for example, initiatives, it's even worse. You know, it's like it's very, very hard to change. So we actually need to change our whole approach to regulation. And then, yes, I think it's worth really thinking about.
You've also talked about changing our approach to government. I mean, you talked about government in most people's minds, the citizenry thinking about it's like a vending machine. You put in your taxes and then something comes out. I think that's a good metaphor that you use. What I'm wondering about, what in lieu of that? I mean, do you envision something that really can replace that system, which is a system that we all live with?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to re-own government. You know, government is a mechanism for collective action. It's a way that we decided together to do things that were very hard to do alone. And getting that right is hard. I mean, there's no question. It's one of the hardest challenges, you know, that any society undertakes. How are we to govern ourselves? The thing that that I've really focused on, and particularly working with my wife, started a nonprofit called Code for America, actually before we were married, but I've joined her in that effort, which is really focused on making government programs actually work. One of the problems we have with government is again, this idea that we build things, but we don't actually make sure that they do what they were intended to do. And we just keep doing them. You know, contrast this with Silicon Valley. You know, if you do a startup and it fails, it goes away, right? And there's that great line in the Aaron Sorkin movie, The Social Network, you know, where the Mark Zuckerberg character talking about the Winklevoss brothers says, if they had built Facebook, they would have built Facebook. You know, the fact is, whatever they did, it may have sounded like it, but it wasn't the same thing. And so there's a similar way. We have these government programs that we mean well. Take healthcare.gov. You know, we meant well. We were trying to do the right thing. And it almost blew up because of such poor implementation. And that poor implementation is riddled throughout our government. So we're making bad decisions where we don't know if the programs are right because they failed on the implementation level, not on the level of policy.
We're talking with Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated. They're holding a summit on the future of work, November 12th and 13th in San Francisco. And speakers include Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella and inventor of Google's driverless car, Sebastian Thrun. Let's talk about Silicon Valley for just a moment. You've talked about it as being too much lottery-minded, and that's, you know, a fair criticism. But how do you change that? How do you alter that?
Well, I think, you know—
In other words, they're going to win the lottery by having a new
app. Yes, exactly.
Sort of
I do think that, you know, in watching the history of technology, some of the most interesting periods have been after when there was something of a drought, you know, where you had people who were doing things for the love of it rather than for money. You know, there was a sort of a whole bubble in the early days of the PC. Microsoft ended up dominating that market and people went somewhere else because there was no money to be made. And they started playing around with this crazy thing called the World Wide Web because it was fun and cool, you know. And then, you know, we kind of saw that repeat as it became harder and harder to get traction in the, you know, on the web. We ended up with this new smartphone market with app developers as an opportunity. So there's this way – the thing that's most interesting is when people are doing it, you know, for love and crazy, you know, ambition, because they see something really important, and there is a sort of almost like a sine wave of innovation, and at the height of that, there's just too much money chasing too few opportunities, and so a lot of what I try to spend time doing on that front is I try to remind Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to work on stuff that matters.
That matters to them.
No, that matters.
It matters to society. It matters to...
That matters in some, you know, here's the thing. If all you're motivated by is, wow, I can get some VC to invest, you're not actually playing to a vision. Now, it could be it matters to you, you know, but I look at the best companies. They have a big goal. You know, think about Microsoft. You know, we want to put a PC on every desk and in every home. That was a vision of universally accessible computing. You think about Google. You know, we want to provide access to make all the world's knowledge, you know, accessible. That's a wonderful, huge vision. You know, Mark Zuckerberg. I want to make the online world more social. You know, those are. You know, big visions, and those are successful companies precisely because they had big visions, I don't want to pick on this, but I want to be the Uber of dry cleaning. You know, it's just like, come on, that's like a Me Too company, and I kind of go, well, why not be the Uber of elder care? You know, that would be much more interesting. One of my proudest moments actually is when some entrepreneur told me that they've been kind of going through a lot of ideas and they didn't pass the Tim O'Reilly test. You know, I want people to go, yeah, I want stuff that really matters, makes the world a better place. And, you know.
Well, let me talk to you about something with respect to the world a better place. I happen to be someone who is very committed to literature and has been my adult life. I read a statement of yours where you said, I don't give a blank about literary novels. they're an elitist pursuit.
Yeah, this was actually
put all these visionary novelists you just wanting to get rid of?
No. You know, you, as is often the case, you have to put it in the full context. And the full context, this was on Charlie Rose. I was trying to get across there's no entitlement to being well paid, right, if nobody wants it. And it was particularly, I was talking to one of the other guests on the show who was sort of like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get, I've had this nice lifestyle where I get paid to write these books. And I look at that, for example, I look on the internet and I see people who are making a new way, a new kind of art. Really great example. I'm not sure you're familiar with the social media feed, Humans of New York. It's this guy. He does it on Tumblr. He does it on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. It's a blog. He's actually ended up with best-selling New York Times books out of it. Every day he goes out and he takes a photograph of someone in the streets of New York and gets a little bit of their story. It is a work of art as profound as any work of art that's ever been, given some literary prize. And so making it new is important. And this idea that somehow we have to protect some particular sort of class of art because the current people really value it, and that somehow, new technology is bad because it's taking attention away or challenging the business model of the old, is, I think, really in some ways it's trying to protect the past against the future. And now I love literature. I love literature. But I also really clear that people who are passionate about literature do it because they're passionate about it. And
if you think you're going to write the great American novel and be a monetary success, you're probably living under a serious delusion.
Well, but it's also—
that's the kind of entitlement I think you were talking about.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think, if you think about something like poetry, poets don't make money. They keep making poetry.
I think Bob Haas, the former poet laureate of the United States, told me that the only book he made money on was poetry for all occasions, like weddings and bar mitzvahs and whatever.
Right, exactly,
We're talking again with Tim O'Reilly, and he is founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. And there's going to be a conference on November 12th and 13th in San Francisco, and there's also an opportunity to speak with our guest. It's going to be the conference on the WTF economy and the future of work, and you may have some thoughts about the future of work or about really what we're talking about here, which is not only, vision when it comes to technology and the future, but also how we can maybe even change and contribute and alter the future so that it doesn't go into dystopia. I'd like to hear your thoughts, and you can join us with this oracular figure, not to be associated necessarily with the Delphic Oracle, maybe more with the Matrix and cookie baking. We invite you to join the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. And again, you can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Number to call, 866-733-6786. And if you'd like to participate in the program, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Welcome your comments there as well, or questions. And you can also go to the Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, Tim O'Reilly and you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated and part of our First Person series. He's been called the Oracle of Silicon Valley. He's also likened himself, I think we go back a few years here, to Jeremiah. But on the other hand, we're hearing a lot of positive things. In fact, I was hearing from him that if he ever met Bill O'Reilly, there would be an antimatter explosion. It's a good line. We're going to go to our callers here and our emails and postings on the website and so forth. But talk about fishing with strawberries. That kind of serves you as a metaphor. Explain what you mean.
Well, this was a piece I wrote probably 25 years ago in an internal company newsletter. And I had met with an investment banker who'd come to see me. And he said, you don't fish with strawberries. You fish with worms because that's what fish like. And I kind of thought about that, and I wrote this message to my employees and said, he's wrong. We do fish with strawberries. What we do is we create products that we love in the faith that there are other people like us. And that's really been a guiding principle for me throughout the years. I've followed my nose. I've basically, you know, I've also compared myself to the Cookie Monster, in terms of the choices I make. There was a segment I remember watching many years ago where the Cookie Monster won a game show, and behind door number one was $1 million. Behind door number two was a chateau in France, and behind door number three was a cookie. And, you know, so many times I've been faced with that kind of choice. And
About cookies in the technological computer
system. No, I just mean cookie, you know. And for me, the cookie is innovation. The cookie is people who do what they love. And, and so I try to go for that. I try to, you'll say, well, how do you figure out what the future is? I see people who are doing interesting things that they love that tell us something about the future. There are people who are living in the future today, and they're excited about it. And those are the people that I want to actually bring to the fore in my events, whose story I want to tell. And anyway.
Does that include somebody like Ray Kurzweil, who talks about our merging with machines and this whole singularity idea?
I am sort of dubious. First of all, I think I have a couple of responses to Ray Kurzweil. The first one is a little bit like Samuel Johnson's response to the idea of Bishop Berkeley that all things exist in the mind. Johnson reputedly kicked a stone and said, "I refute him thus." I think, hey, Ray, it may be true over the long term. I don't know. But I'll tell you, the Hagia Sophia was the largest building in the world for 1,000 years. And that's what we need to be worried about, because you could have a lot of crappy time, where things don't advance.
Do we need to be fearful of artificial intelligence? Because a lot of people are, and you don't seem to be.
Well, first off, I think people don't actually recognize where are we at today. I'm actually working on one of the pieces in my WTF Economy series that I'm publishing on Medium called Our Skynet Moment. I think we're already there. I got to give you a little background for that. One of my fundamental ideas is that we are building a global brain and we are part of it. People have this notion of an AI as something independent from us. But what if instead we are the microbiome of that AI? What if instead, something like Google and all these different applications? Think about this morning. I found out that I had to take BART rather than drive because there was an accident on the bridge, because there were thousands of people driving and that information was being collected into, Google's brain, and it was able to give me that feedback. It's not intelligent, but it's something qualitatively different. You think about news happens on the other side of the world and it flashes across Twitter and Facebook.
I think I read where you were saying you think, to use the old word that isn't used that much anymore, these are like memes that are propagating.
That's right. Memes are propagating. But it's more than that, because we're embedded in systems that we don't control. And this is the Skynet moment. Think about it for a minute when companies justify the fact that we have to, cut our labor costs, because if we don't, the market will punish us. Starbucks saying, Southwest Airlines saying, we have to start charging for, baggage fees, or analysts saying they have to start making baggage fees because otherwise the market will punish them. Who is this market? First of all, it's us, but it's us amplified by a bunch of external systems we've created. And those systems, I think, we need to start looking at them as if they were, in some sense, this proto-AI that we should be worried about, that was out of our control.
Let me bring in our callers. And again, you can join us by calling in at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And we begin with Stephen. Stephen, join us. You're on Forum. Morning.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to ask about Tim O'Reilly's opinion about a specific incident that occurred here in San Francisco just a week ago. Airbnb spent $8 million to convince people in the city to vote against the proposition to essentially maintain more control over it. And many of the people I got calls from around the city are already Airbnb hosts. And it was in their interest to have this passed because they like the revenue to be able to pay their mortgages. But, of course, the availability of this new revenue will increase the price of housing because, of course, the next prospective buyer will say, well, I can rent out part of my house to Airbnb. So the prices will go up. In the end, people won't be any better off in terms of affordability, and the profits that there are to be had will go to the platform. I wanted to comment on that, especially Airbnb's sort of gaming of the political process. And lastly, I'd like to make a comment that Mr. O'Reilly's comments were really beaten by about more than a century ago by another diagnostician, not a great prescriber, but a diagnostician, Marx, because he basically said all these things about capitalism as a machine that does all the same qualities.
Hey, Stephen, let me jump in here because I want to get Tim O'Reilly's response to what you've laid out in terms of your vision of Airbnb in the recent election.
Well, first off, I would say I was opposed to the measure, not because I think that we're at an optimum right now with the current situation, but first of all, because I think initiatives are a very, very dangerous mechanism to use for making public policy because they're very hard to change. And I have a fundamental belief that policy needs to be more adaptable, not less. But secondly, I think picking on Airbnb as an excuse for housing prices is an example of the way that I think we tend to demonize technology that we don't understand. You know, it's not that dissimilar from, you know, all the copyright interests saying, oh, my gosh, you know, Google Books is going to destroy publishing, which didn't turn out to be the case. You know, a lot of the reactions to Uber. We have to figure out how to do this. And like putting a stop to it is the wrong approach. I think if you look at San Francisco real estate prices, I'm sure that Airbnb is a contributor. But relative to all of the factors that are driving this, no. And I think, you know, it's basically being, you know, in a lot of people's minds being singled out because it's new, because it's an identifiable thing. And it's bad.
I think it's also being singled out because of some of the practices that people in high places in Airbnb have availed themselves of. You know, these stories about they're calling people to go to Lyft when they were, you know, they were just doing it to hurt the competition, that sort of thing.
No, you're talking about Uber.
I'm talking about Uber now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No. I mean,
Uber and Airbnb are often
very,
lumped together.
Very, very, very different companies.
Of course, but they're lumped together in the sense of operating, you know, on their own autonomously.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if you look actually at the data, I mean, Airbnb has actually taken steps to try to, for example, prevent people from being commercial renters on the service.
Actually, I think Chip Conley was talking to like the big hotels and so forth to try to work in common with them. But
absolutely, there's a lot of social benefit and there's definitely social risks, and we have to basically engineer our response with nuance. And I think there's a lot to ask for there.
Here's a question from a listener. It says, Tim, can you please tell us where – I'm going to go to more calls in a moment. But it says, Tim, can you please tell us where you stand on outsourcing and H-1Bs? My experience is if you're in tech and you're over 50, your work life is virtually over.
You know, I think in general, this whole narrative about outsourcing and cutting costs is part of this machine I was talking about earlier. You know, great companies find ways to put people to work. I actually look at sort of a lot of the outsourcing trend as actually rooted in some sense, in compensation practices for company management tied to stock market performance. It used to be that companies thought that they had an obligation to their employees, to society. And somewhere back around, you know, in the 80s, it became this, you know, mantra that, no, the only obligation was to make money. And that somehow that was an unalloyed good. And that's a serious mistake. Actually, I just read an article this morning, which was great. It was called something about killing the Hayek monster, Friedrich Hayek, and his ideas. And, you know, the economist who'd written the article was like, this is a nuanced economic thinker who updated his own views. And then there's the monster version who only has, two-word sentences, government bad. Market good. You know, and you know, we've got to get away from these sort of Frankenstein versions of ideology, as opposed to understanding the way the world works and getting better at figuring it out.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Budry. Morning, you're on the air.
Hi, I was really glad to hear Tim O'Reilly say that we should be making more things that matter. Because it's been a frequent complaint of mine that it seems that a lot of the new technologies and apps and startups are seem to be dedicated to just improving the convenience of the life of a sort of class of urban yuppie elite. Like, you know, we'll make an app that walks your dog or takes your dry cleaning out. And, you know, I think of these almost as monuments to laziness in a way. And my question is, how do we disincentivize this type of apps in favor of, you know, real technology that, you know, a smartphone app that would help diagnose cancer or help diagnose depression or things that are much more important and necessary, but of course harder to do? How do we try to incentivize that type of crowdsourced technology?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is where I am very fond of the market, because the market will, in fact, punish those people who are making trivial apps. They will not succeed. They won't matter. And there are some, though, and this is where the market is brilliant. There are some that may start out looking trivial and become important. You know, think about Twitter, for example. I mean, the original vision was, well, let's just, you know, it was really kind of a social app for letting people know, you know, hey, I'm out here drinking. I'm having a party. It was sort of a party app, and it became this amazing news source. And that can evolve. Or you think about something like, Sprig, you know, or some of the other meals kind of programs. What if somebody started using them for Meals on Wheels? Would you suddenly feel a little different about it? Because these things in some ways are platforms, and the capabilities that they bring to our society will evolve over time. You know, in the same way that people used to say, oh, the internet's just cat videos. Well, yeah, it's cat videos, and it's all these amazing things. And I think these are also, these technologies is going to be trivial stuff that gets done. And we're going to figure out over time, oh, that's trivial, we don't need it. And other things we're going to build on and go, yeah, that actually, you know, has become really important.
Here's a tweet from a listener named Yonatan who says, can universal basic income solve mass unemployment?
I don't think it's a matter of solving. Going back to my conversation with David Autor, which I mentioned earlier, we were talking about the contrast between Norway and Saudi Arabia. He said, look, in Saudi Arabia, they look down on work. And
they got so much oil money they don't
right.
have to.
A lot of the jobs in society are done by guest workers. And basically, the society as a whole, you know, a lot of sinecure government jobs for the Saudis. It's not actually a society that we would really like to live in. And that's a stark contrast with Norway. And so the question really is, if we had universal basic income, we still have to value work. And we're going to have to value things that we don't currently value. And that starts with things like teachers. For example, right now we have an average student ratio of something like 30 students per teacher. You go, well, right there, you could triple the number of teachers in this country, because the optimal or quadruple, the optimal number is about 8. You know, as my son-in-law, Saul Griffith, said to me the other night when we were talking about this, he said, you know, if you look at every army in history has been organized in groups of 8, because that actually is like the optimal, team size. And you think about that and you go, wow, you know, right there, simply by reallocating our priorities, by going, wait, education really, really matters. You know, you would change the whole way we think about employment. So if you had money and you were deploying it in the right way, you'd start saying, oh, okay, how do we incentivize that? There's a really great report by Joseph Stiglitz called Rewriting the Rules, which came out just recently. It's turned into a book. But his point, I don't agree with all of his policy recommendations, but just that reminder that we have a lot of rules that govern our market that we take for granted as if they are laws of nature, when in fact they're a human construct. And the fact that we value certain jobs over others. Anyway, so back to the question, if we had universal basic income, it would be the beginning of starting to address unemployment in a different way. But we also have to reallocate and rethink about what we value in society. We have to start thinking more about caring and caring professions. Anne-Marie Slaughter talks about this in her new book quite a bit. But we also have to think about artistic professions. I mentioned earlier Humans of New York, and I think about like if somebody's an actor or an actress and they, work part-time, we think, oh, that's their job. They're an actor, right? If somebody's a poet, we think they're a poet. But if somebody crafts beautiful stuff on social media that's viewed by millions of people, we don't think that's their job, And yet we could. That is something that people do to get meaning. They're sharing stuff with their friends. And so, there may be whole new classes of work.
They're not necessarily monetizing it, though. I think that's the distinction in many people's minds.
Right. But we can actually start to focus more on that. And I think as a society, we need to focus more on how do we get more of the money to creators. And you look at things like Kickstarter and GoFundMe are one mechanism by which that is starting to happen. You look at marketplaces like Etsy. That's a way that that's happening. And we are getting more monetization. I know people who are making good livings on YouTube. And I love it. I'm a huge fan of the Green brothers, John and Hank Green. And they have John Green, best-selling young adult novelist, but also I met them through a conference they run called VidCon, I went to it, and it's sort of like seeing the Beatles in 1964. Their keynote was 2 hours of YouTube stars coming on stage for 5 minutes each and being greeted by tens of thousands of screaming girls. It's like this is actually a phenomenon where there are new kinds of media that are coming on and new kinds of jobs. And you look at some of this stuff, Hank and John have this show called Hank and John Explain. And you go, 2 million kids just watch John explain, back last year, what the hell is going on in Ukraine? That's a new kind of a new cultural phenomenon that's super valuable and just isn't being recognized yet, but will be.
Well, let me hear I'm just going to read this from another source. This is open source, after all. Listener writes, "The good life has less to do with technology and the new and more to do with family, friends, helping others, keeping a home and a garden plot, staying local, protecting the natural world we inherited and appreciating the wonder of it all. Luddites unite."
I'm totally with him on that. I've got chickens in my backyard and grow food in my garden.
You are the opposite of a Luddite. You are a technology advocate and a technology supporter.
These things are not in opposition.
Let's take another call. We go to Santa Cruz. Jeff, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Your speaker, what kind of utopia world are you experiencing here? I'm 61 years old. I've born and raised in San Jose, California. I live in Santa Cruz now. And it is awfully tough for us. I didn't hear you answer the question about over 50 getting jobs. It's impossible.
Let's go to the question then, Tim O'Reilly.
Well, I think I answered it. I think it's not a problem with technology. It's a problem with the financial incentives in our system that encourage companies to cut costs and to cut people above all else. And it doesn't have to be that way.
You don't call yourself a utopianist, though?
I do not.
Okay.
I think that we are in a time of great disruption, and that means a lot of pain and trouble coming our way. And in fact, one of my answers when people say, "What do you think about the future of technological unemployment?" I say, "Okay, I can see three possible futures: one in which we don't deal with huge problems coming at us like climate change, refugee crisis, and the world goes to hell, and we're all working very hard just to stay alive. Two, we realize that we've got to deal with these massive problems. And we're going to want all the technology we can get and bring to bear to transform our economy, to transform our energy grid, to transform our society. And we're all going to be working hard on that problem. And third, we kind of get through all that. And we are in a golden age where we're actually spending more time on this sort of caring and sharing economy."
There's an email from a listener named Ron who says, "WTF is right. I'm a taxi driver in San Francisco, and I'm dealing with the fallout from the WTF economy. All I've seen is a race to the bottom in the transportation industry. Please ask your guests who decided that transportation laws would not be enforced on Uber driver on Uber drivers. Why do they get a free pass? Why do labor laws not apply? Should we undo gains made by labor in the 1930s?
I am confused by that argument against Uber. 85%, I think 87%, according to the TLPA, the Transit Drivers Taxi and Limousine Something Association, 87.5% of all taxi and limousine drivers are independent contractors. They're not any different than Uber drivers. So I don't know what world this person lives in, because that argument, there are arguments against Uber. The argument may be that they will eventually drive down fares, drive down earnings. But in fact, the evidence is Uber drivers make as much as taxi drivers. So this sounds to me, it looks more like a situation in which we have serious competition, but it's not dissimilar from the competition that, say, retailers faced from Amazon or Walmart, or for that matter, Walmart and any of the big box stores. And I would just sort of say if taxis need to modernize. They will compete. I'm very versed in the taxi business because I funded my brother was a taxi driver for many years, and he owns a small fleet of taxis, which I actually loaned him the money to run, to purchase the licenses. And so and I look at how he's dealing with it, and he's like, this is great. I actually have to modernize my service offering. And that's how we need to think about this, because in fact, the experience of, hailing an Uber or a Lyft is way better than the experience of hailing a taxi today. And it doesn't have to be that way. I think, people like Flywheel are kind of transforming taxi fleets. And I do think there are challenges, and I really hear you. And I'm not saying it's easy. I've talked to a lot of taxi drivers as well as Uber and Lyft drivers, and there's pain when there's
the new cab drivers who are complaining.
Yeah, new kinds of competition.
Not the Lyft or the Uber drivers. Actually, I've got a
tweet. Well, some of them complain too, but yeah.
Well, I got a tweet here from Steven who says, can Tim discuss how reducing overall work hours can help address climate change? Some thoughts about that?
That's not something I've thought about, but when I think about actually what we have to do on climate change, I think we need to spend a lot more time on the infrastructure of how we produce energy, because there are, small things that each of us can do, and they do add up. I've replaced all my light bulbs with LEDs because, in fact, they use a lot less energy. All the usual things that we can try to do as individuals. But I do think that it's, the changes in our infrastructure are what's going to matter the most.
There was in one of the articles that you wrote that I read, you were quoting somebody who said the great question of the 20th century is whose black box are you going to trust, which I think is a great question. But here's another great question that sort of as a lie to that. It's a listener who writes, isn't the venture capital system fundamentally flawed in that it is maintaining existing power structures that have created many of the social problems we have today? In this system, those with money have the power to decide what projects are meaningful. What about engaging underserved populations in this process?
Quote from is from John Madison, the chief medical information officer of Kaiser Permanente. Quote. And really does capture a lot of the questions that we need to be asking ourselves and that we're asking at the next economy summit. But as to venture capital being, continuing the existing system, venture capital is one source of new business formation. Just to be clear, I started my company with $500. If you have a vision of serving customers, you can build a business without venture capital. We actually started a new branch of my venture firm, something called IndieVC, which is focused on this notion of building companies that actually have real customers rather than, for example, we're going to grow to hundreds of millions of people who don't pay us in the hopes that either somebody will buy us or will eventually hit on a business model. You can actually start on day one building a business with customers. And yes, underserved communities can be part of that. There's new kinds of things like crowdfunding with Kickstarter and so on. Should venture capital be looking more at some of these underserved markets? I think there are investors who do. We could use a heck of a lot more of that, no question.
Another caller, Helen, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Ms. O'Reilly, I really appreciate your talk about doing what you love as opposed to doing what makes money or whatnot in relation to technology. And I'm noticing as I'm talking to new graduates of with CS degree, comparing where, you know, the perks offered by companies such as, you know, which place has the best free lunches and, you know, free gyms and whatnot in making their employment decision. And I want to get your thoughts on two things. One, am I just talking to the wrong group of people? Is that not the trend? But if it is the trend, then I want to get your thoughts on if you think this is a problem and what we can do about it.
Okay, we got seconds left here. Tim O'Reilly.
Well, first off, I do think that that trend is starting to slow down as money gets a little less easy. I think some of the high-tech companies that I visit actually are cutting back on some of those perks a little bit. But should we make workplaces great for employees? Absolutely. The thing I guess I would just sort of like to close with here really quickly is there is a wave of technology coming that dwarfs the original internet. And it's going to transform our society. And I think those are the issues we have to come to grips with. It's not just media anymore. It's every business that needs to be thinking about this future. And part of that future is how do we have companies that create good jobs? Because those people who work for us, not just the super high, so-called high value, the 10X programmers, but every employee is an asset. And we need to start thinking about people as assets and not as costs.
Now, the Summit on the Future of Work will be held in San Francisco November 12th and 13th. And Tim O'Reilly, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, our listeners, and thank you, our callers and emailers. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.